This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. It's a delight to be with you this evening. My wife is with me, and this is our first visit to Manchester. We enjoy driving about the Peak District and experiencing some of the beauty of the countryside in this area this afternoon. And my delight at being here this evening is only overshadowed in a sense by the sobriety of the topic that we're dealing with tonight, this very important question of the meaning and the significance of life, and asking the question, is life without God absurd? Man, writes Lauren Isley, is the cosmic orphan. He's the only creature in the universe who asks why. Other animals have instincts to guide them. But man has learned to ask questions. Who am I? He asks. Why am I here? Where am I going? Well, ever since the Enlightenment, when modern man threw off the shackles of religion, he's tried to answer those questions without reference to God. But the answers that came back were not exhilarating, but dark and terrible. You are the accidental byproduct of nature, the result of matter plus time plus chance. There is no reason for your existence. All you face is death. Modern man thought that in getting rid of God, he had freed himself from everything that stifled and oppressed him. Instead, he discovered that in killing God, he had only succeeded in orphaning himself. For if there is no God, then man's life becomes ultimately absurd. If God does not exist, then both man and the universe are inevitably doomed to death. Man, like all biological organisms, must die. With no hope of immortality, man's life leads only to the grave. His life is but a spark in the infinite blackness, a spark that appears, flickers, and dies forever. Compared to the infinite stretch of time, the span of man's life is but an infinitesimal moment, and yet this is all the life that he will ever know. And the universe, too, faces a death of its own. Scientists tell us that the universe is expanding, and as it does so, its energy is used up, and it grows colder and colder. Eventually, all the stars will burn out, and all matter will collapse into dead stars and black holes. There will be no light. There will be no life. There will be no heat. Only the corpses of dead stars and galaxies, ever expanding into the endless darkness and the cold recesses of space, a universe in ruins. So not only is the life of each individual person doomed, the entire human race is doomed. The universe is plunging toward inevitable extinction. Death is written throughout its structure. There is no escape. There is no hope. If there is no God, then man and the universe are doomed. Like prisoners condemned to death, we await our unavoidable execution. There is no God, and there is no immortality. And what is the consequence of this? It means that life itself becomes absurd. It means that the life we do have is without ultimate significance, value, or purpose. Let's look briefly at each one of these. First, no ultimate meaning without God. If each individual person passes out of existence when he dies, then what ultimate meaning can be given to his life? Does it really matter whether he ever existed at all? Someone might say, well, his life was important because it affected others or influenced the course of history. But that shows only a relative significance to his life, not an ultimate significance. His life may be important relative to certain other events, But what is the ultimate significance of any of those events? If all the events are meaningless, then what can be the ultimate importance of influencing any of them? Ultimately, it makes no difference. The same is true of the human race in general. Mankind is a doomed race in a dying universe. Because the human race will eventually cease to exist, it makes no ultimate difference whether it ever did exist. Mankind is thus no more significant than a swarm of mosquitoes or a barnyard of pigs, for their end is all the same. The same blind cosmic process that coughed them all up in the first place will eventually swallow them all up again. And thus the contributions of the scientist to the advance of human knowledge, the researches of the doctor to alleviate pain and suffering in the world, the sacrifices of good people everywhere to better the lot of the human race, all of these come to nothing. In the end, they don't make one bit of difference, not one bit. And because each person's life is ultimately meaningless, the activities that we fill our lives with are also meaningless. The long hours spent in study at the university, our jobs, our friendships, our interests, all of these are, in the final analysis, ultimately meaningless. This is the horror of modern man. Because he ends in nothing, he ultimately is nothing. The French existentialists, Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, understood this too well. Sartre portrays life in his play No Exit as hell. The final line of the play are the words of resignation, well, let's get on with it. Hence, Sartre speaks elsewhere of the nausea of existence. Man, he says, is adrift in a boat without a rudder on an endless sea. Camus also saw life as absurd. Life, he says, is like a man condemned to push a boulder up a hill only to have it roll down again, over and over again for all eternity. At the end of his brief novel, The Stranger, Camus' hero discovers in a flash of insight that there is no God and that the universe has no meaning. The French biochemist Jacques Monod seems to echo these sentiments when he wrote in his book Chance and Necessity, man finally knows that he is alone in the indifferent immensity of the universe. Thus, if there is no God, then life itself becomes ultimately meaningless. Man and the universe are without any ultimate significance. Secondly, no ultimate value without God. If life ends at the grave, then ultimately it makes no difference whether one has lived as a Stalin or as a Mother Teresa, since one's destiny is ultimately unrelated to one's behavior. You may as well just live as you please. As the Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky put it, if there is no immortality, then all things are permitted. On this basis, a writer like Ayn Rand is absolutely correct to praise the virtues of selfishness. You might as well live totally for self. No one holds you accountable. Indeed, it would be foolish to do anything else, since life is too short to jeopardize it by acting out of anything but pure self-interest. But the problem becomes even worse, for regardless of immortality, if there is no God, then there can be no objective standards of right and wrong. All we are confronted with, in Jean-Paul Sartre's words, is the bare, valueless fact of existence. Moral values are either just expressions of personal taste or the byproducts of socio-biological evolution and conditioning. In the words of one humanist philosopher, the moral principles that govern our behavior are rooted in habit and custom, feeling and fashion. In a world without God, who is to say that the values of Adolf Hitler are inferior to those of a saint? Who's to judge whose values are right and whose are wrong? The concept of morality loses all objective meaning in a universe without God. As one contemporary atheistic ethicist points out, To say that something is wrong because it is forbidden by God is perfectly understandable to anyone who believes in a law-giving God. But to say that something is wrong even though no God exists to forbid it is not understandable. He says the concept of moral obligation is unintelligible apart from the idea of God. The words remain, but their meaning is gone. In a world without God, there can be no objective right and wrong, but simply our culturally and personally relative subjective judgments. This means that it is impossible to condemn war, oppression, or crime as objectively evil and wrong. Nor can one praise brotherhood, equality, or love as objectively good. For in a universe without God, good and evil do not exist. There is only the bare, valueless fact of existence, and there is no one to say that you are right and that I am wrong. Thirdly, no ultimate purpose without God. If death stands with open arms at the end of life's trail, then what is the goal of life? To what end has life been? Is it all for nothing? Is there no reason for life? And what of the universe? Is it utterly pointless? If its destiny is a cold grave in the recesses of outer space, then the universe is pointless. The answer is yes. There is no goal, no purpose for the universe. The litter of a dead universe will just go on expanding and expanding forever. And what of man? Is there no purpose at all for the human race? Or will it simply peter out someday, lost in the oblivion of an indifferent universe? The writer H.G. Wells foresaw such a prospect. In his novel, The Time Machine, Wells' time traveler journeys far into the distant future in order to discover the destiny of man. All he finds is a dead Earth, except for a few lichens and moss, orbiting a gigantic red sun. The only sounds are the rush of the wind and the gentle ripple of the sea. Beyond these lifeless sounds, writes Wells, the world was silent. Silent? It would be hard to convey the stillness of it. All the sounds of man, the bleating of sheep, the cries of birds, the hum of insects, the stir that makes the background of our lives, all that was over. And so Wells' time traveler returned. But to what? To merely an earlier point on the same purposeless rush towards oblivion. When, as a non-Christian, I first read Wells' book, I thought, no, it can't end that way. But this is reality in a universe without God. If there is no God, it will end that way, like it or not. This is reality without God. There is no hope. There is no purpose. I'm reminded of T.S. Eliot's haunting lines, "This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper." And what is true of mankind as a whole is true of each of us individually. We are here to no purpose. If there is no God, then our life is not qualitatively different from that of a dog. I know that that sounds harsh, but it's true. As the ancient writer of the book of Ecclesiastes put it, "The fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over the beast. For all is vanity. All go to the same place. All are from the dust, and all return to dust again." In this book, which reads more like a piece of modern existentialist literature than a book from the Bible, the author shows the futility of pleasure, wealth, education, political fame, and honor in a life doomed to end in death. His verdict, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. If life ends at the grave, then we have no ultimate purpose for living. But more than that, even if life did not end in death, without God, life would still be without purpose. For man and the universe, would then be simple accidents of chance, thrust into existence for no reason whatsoever. Without God, the universe is the result of a cosmic accident, a chance explosion. There is no reason for which the universe exists. And as for man, he is a freak of nature, a blind product of matter plus time plus chance. There is no more purpose for the human race than for a species of insect, for both are the result of the blind interaction of chance and necessity. As Richard Dawkins has written, there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pointless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. It is every living object's sole reason for being. And what is true of the universe and of the human race as a whole is also true of us as individuals. Insofar as we are individual human beings, we are the results of a certain combination of heredity and environment. As Dawkins puts it, we are possibly the only planet in the universe where chunks of matter are so complex that they can swim, run, jump, see, hear, capture, and eat other such animated chunks of complexity. They are capable, in some cases, of thinking and feeling and falling in love with other chunks of complex matter. If God does not exist, then you are just a freak of nature thrust into a purposeless universe to live a purposeless life. So, if God does not exist, that means that man and the universe exist to no purpose, since the end of everything is death, and that they came to be for no purpose, since they are only blind products of chance and necessity. In short, life is utterly without reason. I hope you grasp the gravity of the alternatives before us. If God exists, then there is hope for man. But if God does not exist, then all we are left with is despair. As one modern writer has aptly put it, if God is dead, then man is dead too. Unfortunately, the mass of mankind do not realize this fact. They continue on as though nothing had changed. I'm reminded of Friedrich Nietzsche's story of the madman who, in the early morning hours, burst into the marketplace, lantern in hand, crying, "I seek God! I seek God!" Since many of those standing about did not believe in God, he provoked much laughter. "Did God get lost?" they taunted him. "Or is he hiding? Or maybe he's gone on a voyage or emigrated," and thus they yelled and laughed. And then, writes Nietzsche, the madman turned in their midst and pierced them with his eyes. "Whither is God?" he cried. "I shall tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how have we done this? How were we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What did we do when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually, backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there any up or down left? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night and more night coming on all the while? Must not lanterns be lit in the morning? Do we not hear anything yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? God is dead! And we have killed him. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves?" The crowd stared at the madman in astonishment and silence. At last, he dashed his lantern to the ground. "I have come too early," he said. "This tremendous event has not yet reached the ears of men." Men did not truly comprehend what they had done in killing God. But Nietzsche predicted that someday people would realize the implications of their atheism. And this realization would usher in an age of nihilism, that is to say, the destruction of all meaning and value in life. "This most gruesome of guests," said Nietzsche, "is standing already at the door. Our whole European culture is moving for some time now, wrote Nietzsche, with a tortured tension that is growing from decade to decade as toward a catastrophe, restlessly, violently, headlong, like a river that wants to reach the end, that no longer reflects, that is afraid to reflect. Most people, I find, still do not reflect upon the consequences of atheism. And so, like the crowd in the marketplace, go unknowingly on their way. But when we realize, as did Nietzsche, the consequences of atheism, then his question presses hard upon us. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? About the only solution that the atheist can offer to this human predicament is that we face the absurdity of life and live bravely. Bertrand Russell, for example, wrote that we must build our lives upon the firm foundation of unyielding despair. Only by recognizing that the world really is a terrible place can we successfully come to terms with life. Camus said that we should simply honestly face the absurdity of life and then live in love for one another. But the problem with this solution, however, is that it is impossible to live consistently and happily within the framework of such a worldview. If one lives consistently, then he will not be happy. If one lives happily, then it is only because he is not consistent. Francis Schaeffer has explained this point very well. Modern man, says Schaeffer, resides in a two-story universe. In the lower story is the finite world, without God. Here, life is absurd. In the upper story are meaning, value, and purpose. Now, modern man lives in the lower story because he does not believe in God. But he cannot live happily in such an absurd universe. Therefore, he continually makes leaps of faith to the upper story to affirm meaning, value, and purpose in life, even though he has no right to, since man in the lower story does not believe in God. Modern man is thus totally inconsistent when he makes these leaps of faith. Because these values cannot exist without God, and man in the lower story does not have God. Let's look again, then, briefly at each of those three areas in which we saw that life was absurd without God, to show how man cannot live consistently and happily within the framework of an atheistic worldview. First, the area of meaning in life. We saw that without God, life is ultimately meaningless. Yet philosophers continue to live as though life did have meaning. For example, Sartre argued that one may create meaning for one's life by freely choosing to follow a certain course of action. Sartre himself chose Marxism. Now, this is utterly inconsistent. It is inconsistent to say that life is objectively meaningless and then to say that one may create a meaning for his life. If life really is absurd, then man is trapped in the lower story. To try to create meaning in life represents a leap to the upper story. But Sartre has no basis for such a leap. Without God, there can be no objective meaning in life. Sartre's program is actually an exercise in self-delusion. I think this is easy to see. The universe doesn't really acquire a meaning simply because I happen to give it one. For suppose I give the universe one meaning and you give it another. Who's right? Well, the obvious answer is neither one. For the universe without God remains objectively meaningless, no matter how we happen to regard it. Sartre is really saying, let's pretend the universe has meaning. And that is just fooling yourself. The point is this, if God does not exist, then the life is objectively meaningless. But man cannot live consistently and happily knowing that life is meaningless. So, in order to be happy, he pretends that life has meaning. And this is, of course, entirely inconsistent. For without God, man and the universe are without any real significance. Turn now to the problem of value in life. Here is where the most blatant inconsistencies occur. First of all, atheistic humanists are totally inconsistent in affirming the traditional values of love and human brotherhood. Camus has been rightly criticized for inconsistently holding to both moral nihilism on the one hand and to the ethics of human love and brotherhood on the other. The two are logically incompatible. Bertrand Russell also was inconsistent. For though Russell was an atheist, he was also an outspoken social critic, denouncing war and restrictions on sexual freedom. Russell admitted that he could not live as though ethical values were simply a matter of personal taste, and that he therefore found his own views, and I quote, "incredible. I do not know the solution," he confessed. The point is that if there is no God, then objective right and wrong cannot exist. As Dostoevsky said, all things are permitted. But Dostoevsky also showed that man cannot live this way. He cannot live as though it's perfectly all right for soldiers to slaughter innocent children. He cannot live as though it's perfectly all right for dictatorial regimes to follow a systematic program of physical torture of political prisoners. He cannot live as though it's all right for dictators like Pol Pot or Saddam Hussein to ruthlessly exterminate millions of their own countrymen. Everything in him cries out to say that these acts are wrong, really wrong. But if there is no God, he cannot. And so he makes a leap of faith and affirms values anyway. And when he does so, he reveals the inadequacy of a world without God. If God does not exist, then ultimately there is no absolute right and wrong. All things are permitted. But no atheist, no agnostic can live consistently with such a worldview. Nietzsche himself, who proclaimed the necessity of living beyond good and evil, broke with his mentor, Richard Wagner, precisely over the issue of the composer's strident German nationalism and anti-Semitism. Similarly, Sartre, writing in the aftermath of the Second World War, condemned anti-Semitism, declaring that a doctrine that leads to extermination is not merely an opinion or matter of personal taste of equal value with its opposite. In his important essay, "Existentialism is a Humanism," Sartre struggles vainly to elude the contradiction between his denial of divinely preordained values and his urgent desire to affirm the value of human persons. Like Russell, he could not live with the implications of his own denial of ethical absolutes. Indeed, one will probably never find an atheist who can live consistently within his system, for a universe without moral accountability and devoid of value is unimaginably terrible. Finally, let's look at the area of purpose in life. The only way most people who deny purpose in life live happily is either by making up some purpose for their life, which amounts to self-delusion, as we saw with Sartre, or by not carrying out their view to its logical conclusions. Take the problem of death, for example. According to the psychologist Ernst Bloch, the only way modern man lives in the face of death is by subconsciously borrowing the belief in immortality which his ancestors held to, even though he himself has no basis for this belief, since he does not believe in God. Bloch states that the belief that life ends in nothing is hardly, in his words, sufficient to keep the head high and to work as if there were no end. By borrowing the remnants of a belief in immortality, writes Bloch, modern man does not feel the chasm that unceasingly surrounds him and that will certainly engulf him at last. Through these remnants, he saves his sense of self-identity. Through them, the impression arises that man is not perishing, but only that one day the world has the whim no longer to appear to him. Bloch concludes, this quite shallow courage thus feasts on a borrowed credit card. It lives from earlier hopes and the support that they had once provided. But modern man no longer has any right to that support since he rejects God. But in order to live purposefully, he makes a leap of faith to affirm a reason for living. And it's interesting to see many of these thinkers betray their views when pushed to their logical conclusions. Take, for example, the biological determinism of a man like Richard Dawkins. While espousing physical reductionism and treating love and compassion for others unrelated to ourselves as a, quote, misfiring in our brains, a, quote, Darwinian mistake, end quote, he hastens to reassure his readers that it is a blessed, precious mistake, in no way demeaning to the noble emotions of compassion and generosity. He says he was mortified to learn that his book, The Selfish Gene, was the favorite book of Jeff Skilling, whom you'll recall was convicted for swindling millions of dollars from other complex chunks of matter in the struggle for survival. In order to provide some inspiration in life, Dawkins admits, the method of argument I must employ is rhetoric rather than logic. Modern man cannot live consistently and happily as though life were ultimately without meaning, value, and purpose. If we try to live consistently within the atheistic framework, we shall find ourselves profoundly unhappy. If we manage to live happily, it is only by giving lie to the atheistic worldview. Confronted with this dilemma, modern man flounders pathetically for some means of escape. In a remarkable address to the American Academy for the Advancement of Science several years ago, Dr. Loyal D. Rue, confronted with the predicament of modern man, boldly advocated that we deceive ourselves by some noble lie into thinking that we in the universe still have value, claiming that the lesson of the past two centuries is that intellectual and moral relativism is profoundly the case. Dr. Rue muses that the consequence of such a realization is that one's quest for personal wholeness or self-fulfillment and the quest for social coherence become independent of one another. This is because, on the view of relativism, the search for self-fulfillment becomes radically privatized. Each person chooses his own set of values and meaning in life. There is no final, objective reading on the world or the self, Rue writes. There is no universal vocabulary for integrating cosmology and morality. If we are to avoid, he says, the madhouse option, where self-fulfillment is pursued at the expense of social coherence, and to avoid the totalitarian option, where social coherence is imposed at the expense of personal wholeness, then, he says, we have no choice but to embrace some noble lie that will inspire us to live beyond selfish interests and so achieve social coherence. A noble lie is one that deceives us, tricks us, and so compels us to live beyond self-interest, beyond ego, beyond family, nation, and race. It is a lie because it tells us that the universe is infused with meaning, which is a great fiction, because it makes a claim to universal truth when there is none, and because it tells me not to live for my own self-interest, which is manifestly false. And yet, says Rue, without such lies, we cannot live. This is the dreadful verdict pronounced over modern man. In order to survive, he must live in self-deception. But even the noble lie option is, in the end, unworkable. For how can one believe in these noble lies while at the same time believing in atheism and relativism? the more convinced you are of the necessity of a noble lie, the less you are able to believe in it. Like a placebo, the noble lie only works on those who believe it is the truth. Once we have seen through the fiction, then the lie has lost its power over us. Thus, ironically, the noble lie cannot solve the human predicament for anyone who has come to see that predicament. The noble lie option therefore leads, at best, to a society in which an elitist group of Illuminati deceive the masses for their own good by perpetrating the noble lie. But then why should those of us who are enlightened follow the masses in their deception? Why should we sacrifice our self-interest for a fiction? If the great lesson of the past two centuries is moral and intellectual relativism, then why, if we could, pretend that we do not know this truth and live a lie instead? If one answers, for the sake of social coherence, one may legitimately ask why I should sacrifice my self-interest for the sake of social coherence. The only answer the relativist can give is that social coherence is in my best self-interest. But the problem with this answer is that self-interest and the interest of the herd do not always coincide. Besides, if out of self-interest I do care about social coherence, the totalitarian option is always open to me. Forget the noble lie and maintain social coherence as well as my self-fulfillment at the expense of the personal wholeness of the masses. Generations of Soviet leaders who extolled proletarian virtues as they rode in limousines and dined in caviar in their country dachas found this alternative to be quite workable. Now, Rue would undoubtedly regard such an option as repugnant, but therein lies exactly the rub. Rue's dilemma is that he obviously values deeply both social coherence and personal wholeness for their own sakes. In other words, they are objective values, which, according to his philosophy, do not exist. He has already leapt to the upper story. The noble lie option thus affirms what it denies and so refutes itself. But if atheism fails in this regard, what about biblical Christianity? According to the Christian worldview, God does exist and life does not end at the grave. Through the resurrection, man may enjoy eternal life and fellowship with God forever. Biblical Christianity thereby provides the two conditions necessary for a meaningful, valuable, and purposeful life: God and immortality. Because of this, we can live consistently and happily within the framework of the worldview of biblical Christianity. In the Christian view, the meaning of life is to be found in relationship with God. Knowing God is the fulfillment of human existence. It is what we were made for. Moral values are grounded in the nature of God. God's own holy and loving nature is the absolute standard by which all actions and measures, actions and decisions are measured. And his commandments toward us constitute our moral duties. The purpose of life is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever, in fellowship personally with ultimate goodness and love. And thus, biblical Christianity succeeds precisely where atheism breaks down. Now, I want to make it clear that I have not in any way shown biblical Christianity to be true. But what I have done this evening is to clearly spell out the alternatives. If God does not exist, then life is ultimately absurd. If the God of the Bible does exist, then life is meaningful. Only the second of these two alternatives enables us to live consistently and happily. And therefore, it seems to me that even if the evidence for these two options were absolutely equal, a rational person ought to choose to believe in biblical Christianity. That is to say, it seems to me positively irrational, if the evidence is equal, to prefer death, futility, and destruction to life, meaningfulness, and happiness. As Pascal said, we have nothing to lose and infinity to gain. Well, at this time, I'll be happy to entertain any questions that you might have. Good question. The question was, I've spoken with respect to modern atheism and secularism, but I haven't addressed other world religions like Buddhism, for example. And the reason for that is I am speaking to a Western audience. When I have been in China, I've addressed similar issues with a quite different sort of audience. But I think that Buddhism lacks the two ingredients necessary for meaning, value, and purpose, namely God and immortality. On the Buddhist view, there is no personal immortality. Indeed, there isn't even an enduring self. And there certainly is no personal God to serve as the foundation of moral values or as the bestower of purpose in life. And so Buddhism is essentially an agnostic or atheistic philosophy of life. It's really an attempt to see how to get through a life filled with suffering and pain without God. And I don't think it ultimately provides any answer to the very problems that we've been discussing tonight. Ultimately, life is absurd, I would say, within that sort of worldview. So what I think you need as the necessary and sufficient conditions for a meaningful life would be God and immortality. And any religion lacking those would fall short in that respect. Very good question. The question was, if I say that people creating their own values is merely subjective and not a basis for objective moral values, what about God himself? Does God sort of create his own values? Are they equally subjective? And I would say not in the way that I understand it. As I understand it, God's own moral character is the paradigm for moral values. It's not that God made up moral values. I'm not what's called a voluntarist, where it says God just sort of invented these. Rather, morality is descriptive of the very nature of God himself. God's character is what Plato called the good. It is the paradigm of what goodness is. And this expresses itself necessarily to us in the form of certain divine commandments which constitute our moral duties. And because it's the paradigm, it makes no sense to try to compare it to something else to see if it measures up to be objective. It is itself the paradigm. To give an illustration, we used to speak of a high-fidelity recording. And that meant that the recording of, say, a symphony was very close to the sound of a live orchestra. So that you would say this is a high-fidelity recording. It's faithful. It's close to the sound of a live orchestra. But it would be nonsensical to ask if the sound of the live orchestra was high-fidelity, because it is the paradigm for what high-fidelity is. And so if there is to be objective moral value in life, you ultimately have to come to some stopping point, and I would say that this is the character of God himself. Yes, the question is, well, why couldn't that point be man himself? Well, I think within the atheistic view, the reason would be that given what the atheist believes about man, I think that naturalism is the most plausible atheistic worldview. And on that view, human beings are nothing special. They're just animals. They're just relatively advanced primates. As Dawkins says, they're DNA replicators. And there doesn't seem to be anything about them that would make their herd morality objectively true any more than, say, guinea pig morality. Why should actions conducive to the flourishing of this species be any more significant than actions conducive to the flourishing of guinea pig species? So, honestly, it seems to me that on an atheistic view, on a naturalistic view, human beings are just relatively advanced primates and are not moral agents at all. I can't see any basis for affirming the objectivity of their morality. Yes, the question was, I mentioned oppression as one example of an evil. Should Christians be involved in battling oppression, and in what ways? Well, yes, I certainly think we should. I think that part of the responsibility of Christians is to be peacemakers, to be salt and light in a fallen world. And as you look at efforts of Christians throughout history, you'll find that they have led movements for social reform, like the abolition of slavery, the establishment of hospitals, the modern nursing profession. They have been involved in efforts to bring peace through diplomatic efforts in the world, founders of universities and educational institutions. So certainly, as Christians, I think we ought to be involved in fighting against oppression, and historically Christians have been leaders in this fight. Very good question. Is Christianity a noble lie? Is Christianity a noble lie? I haven't given any evidence for Christianity tonight, have I? Perhaps Christianity is itself a noble lie, and I'm convinced of it, and therefore I'm able to live happily and consistently within that framework. Well, in order to answer that question, what we need to do is to look at the evidence. And two nights ago, I gave a lecture in Oxford on five reasons to believe that God exists. And I think, however unfashionable it may be, that there are good reasons to believe that God exists. And I regularly interact with my atheist and agnostic colleagues on these reasons. When they have published critiques, I have responded in the professional journals to those critiques. I've debated with them. I think that there is good evidence to believe that God exists. Moreover, I also think that there is good reason to believe that this God, who has created the universe and is the foundation of moral value, has revealed himself decisively in Jesus of Nazareth. And I think it's tomorrow night I'll be debating with James Crossley at Sheffield University on the subject, did Jesus rise from the dead? He's a New Testament professor there, and we'll be exploring the evidence for that. So I don't think it's a noble lie, though I think the question is an urgent one and is entirely appropriate to ask. I would look at the evidence and argue, no, this is in fact the truth, that the truth about reality is much more wonderful than the atheist would have us believe. Mm-hmm. The question is it not selfish to seek this relationship with God and immortality? I don't think so at all. I would say, in fact, that if God exists, imagine that hypothesis, if God exists, then we actually have a moral obligation to seek him and to love him, because God is the ultimate good. He is what medieval theologians call the summum bonum, the ultimate good. He is indeed the locus of goodness itself. So I would say that far from being selfish, we are actually morally obligated to seek and to love God. But the wonder of this is that in so doing, we find ourselves fulfilled, because it is the fulfillment of human existence to be in relationship to this source of infinite goodness and love. So if God exists, I think it's not at all selfish. Though, I would agree with you, it is in my self-interest. It's certainly in my self-interest, because it will be the fulfillment of my existence to know him. But I don't equate something's being in my self-interest with being selfish. I mean, it's in my self-interest to eat, for example, and to inhale. But that's not selfish to do those things. Okay, I think I understand now. When you look at the lot of a medieval peasant, it was a pretty hard life. But I don't think that it was because of religion, per se. On the contrary, the church probably provided one of the few sources of relief for the life of a medieval peasant, particularly for those who had the chance to become educated. It was only the church that preserved literacy during those ages that you speak of. And any appreciation of art or beauty would probably come through its expression in the church. But certainly the feudal sort of society in which he lived was very hard and in that sense oppressive. But I wouldn't attribute that to the truth of Christianity. don't think that as a Christian I am obligated to defend every institutional expression of Christianity that has existed in history. I would not be in favor of a sort of church-state alliance such as you had in feudal society. I wouldn't support that. So I don't think, as a biblical Christian, I'm committed to every institutional expression of my faith that it has taken historically. But I do want to affirm very emphatically your final points, that it is critical that we ask ourselves what is the true concept of God. Because clearly, in our day and age, we find, for example, in the contest of ideas between Islam and Christianity, quite radically different concepts of God, and particularly of moral values. The one God says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Turn the other cheek if someone strikes you on the cheek. The other God says, pursue jihad against the pagans and unbelievers until all of them are subdued and they pay tribute out of their hand. So you have very different expressions of the concept of who God is in these competing monotheisms. And so you're absolutely correct that it is vital that we look into the evidence for these competing worldviews and assess which one has the best claim to be true. And that, again, would be a talk for another evening. I haven't addressed that tonight. My talk this evening would simply say that we need the two necessary conditions of God and immortality for a meaningful life. But then the further question is, all right, well, which God then are we talking about? And that would be a vital question, I think. Yes, the question was, in the major world religions today, there are three competing monotheisms, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. What thumbnail sketch might one give of the key differences here? Well, apart from the moral difference that I just mentioned, I think that the key difference will be with respect to their attitude toward Jesus of Nazareth. Neither Judaism nor Islam sees Jesus of Nazareth as divine, but merely as either in one case a messianic pretender who was crucified, or in the other case as the Messiah, but not as someone who was crucified but was a human prophet and was not divine. And so in weighing the evidence for these three monotheisms, I think we will not be looking at evidence pertinent to the creation of the universe or the design in nature or the foundation of moral values and so forth. But what we'll be looking at will be the historical reliability of the New Testament's witness to the person of Jesus of Nazareth. Whom did he think he was? Whom did he claim to be? And is there any evidence to indicate that what he said was true? And this will be especially relevant to the claims of the early Christians that God raised him from the dead as a vindication that he was, in fact, a decisive revelation from God. So I see Jesus as the great stumbling block, so to speak. It will be in one's attitude toward Jesus that these different monotheisms will part. Okay, well, he asked a personal question. How is it that one achieves a personal relationship with God, and how did that happen in my own life? So a personal question deserves a personal answer. I myself wasn't raised in a Christian home or even a church-going family. But when I reached middle teens, I began to ask the kinds of questions that I'm talking about tonight. Who am I? What is the meaning of my existence? Why am I here? And I felt deeply the despair and the darkness that I have tried to describe tonight. I had never read an existentialist philosopher. It wasn't until years later that I read Sartre and Camus in college and realized that I had felt the absurdity and the despair that the existentialists described. And I resonated immediately with their writings because I had been through this myself. And in my search for answers, I had begun to attend a local church in our community, but I didn't find any answers there. All I found was hypocrisy. The other students who attended this church lived for their real God the rest of the week, which was popularity. And that really bothered me because I thought, I am so spiritually empty inside. And yet externally, I'm living a better life than they are, and they claim to be Christians. They're all a bunch of hypocrites. And I became very bitter toward the institutional church because of the phoniness that I thought it represented. And I wanted to disassociate myself from the people who were in it because of their hypocrisy. And soon this attitude of mine began to spread toward other people. I thought, everybody is a phony. They're all holding up plastic masks to the world. And the real person is cowering down inside, afraid to come out and be real. And so I began to withdraw from people. I said, I don't want to be with people. I detest them. They're phonies. They're fakes. And I threw myself into my studies. I was on my way, frankly, toward becoming a very alienated young man. And yet, in moments of introspection and honesty, when I would look into my own heart, I realized that deep down inside, I really did want to love and to be loved, just like other people. And I realized at that moment I was just as much a hypocrite as they were, because here I was pretending not to need people when deep down inside I knew I really did. And so that anger turned in on myself for my own phoniness and hypocrisy. And I don't know if you understand what this is like, but this kind of inner anger just eats away at your insides, making every day miserable, another day to get through. And I remember looking at a dog and thinking, why did I have to be born a human being? I didn't ask to be born. Why do I have to be a human being who has to ask questions about the meaning of his existence and the purpose of life? That dog doesn't have any struggle in that respect. He just eats and lives and is happy. Why couldn't I have been a dog? That was the way I felt. And I walked into my high school German class one day, and I sat down behind a girl who's one of these types that is always so happy, it just makes you sick. And I tapped her on the shoulder, and she turned around, and I said to her, Sandy, what are you always so happy about anyway? And she said, well, Bill, it's because I know Jesus Christ as my personal Savior. And I said, well, I go to church. And she said, that's not enough, Bill. You've got to have him really living in your heart. And I said, well, what would he want to do a thing like that for? And she said, because he loves you, Bill. And that just hit me like a ton of bricks. Here I was so filled with anger and hate inside. And she said, there was someone who loved me. And who was it but the God of the universe? And that thought just staggered me. I mean, I knew enough about astronomy to realize that I was just an infinitesimal speck on this tiny dot called the planet Earth, lost in this huge and mindless universe. And the thought that the God of the universe loved me just staggered me. I had never thought of this before. Well, I went home and I found a New Testament and I began to read it for the first time. And as I did so, I was absolutely captivated by the person of Jesus of Nazareth. There was a wisdom about his teaching that I had never encountered before. And there was an authenticity about his life that wasn't characteristic of these people who claimed to be his followers in that local church I was going to. And I realized then I couldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Sandy introduced me to other Christians in the high school. I'd never met people like this. It was as though they were in contact with a different plane of reality that I never even knew existed. And it imparted a deep meaning and peace and joy to their lives that I craved. And as I read my New Testament, I realized that my problem was that through my moral failure, that is to say, through the wrong things that I had said and done and thought, that I was morally guilty before God and therefore spiritually separated from him. And therefore, it was no wonder that God seemed so unreal to me and I felt so empty inside. But that it said that God had sent Christ into the world to pay the penalty for my sin, my moral failure, and to restore to me the relationship with God that I was created to have and should have. And all I had to do was to commit my life to him, invite him to come into my life and to make me over anew inside and to forgive me and restore that relationship. Well, I went through about 6 months of the most intense soul-searching that I've ever been through in my life. until finally I just came to the end of my rope and I just cried out to God and just cried out all the anger and the bitterness that was inside of me. And at the same time, I felt this tremendous infusion of joy, like a balloon being blown up until it was ready to pop. And I rushed outside. It was a warm Midwestern September evening. And I could see the Milky Way from horizon to horizon. And I looked up at the stars and I thought, God, I've come to know God. And that moment just changed my whole life, because I had thought enough about this to realize that if this were the truth, if this were really the truth, that I could do nothing less than give my whole life to sharing this good news with mankind. So that's how I became a Christian. And my studies since then have only deepened my conviction of the truth of this and the wonder of it. As I say, coming to read French existentialism and ethics philosophy helped me to see that the insights that I had as a high school youngster into the despair and the meaninglessness of life were also insights that many, many great thinkers had also wrestled with, like Nietzsche and Sartre and others, and confirmed in my thinking that that quest that I had been on was indeed the right quest and that it had issued in the right answers. Yes, I thought you were going to ask that. That is a huge question, which deserves an entire lecture. And I am going to be speaking on that Friday at Cambridge University, on how a good God can permit so much suffering and evil. And in this brief question time, I don't want to give what would sound like a pat answer, because this is a difficult question. Let me just say a couple of things about that by way of partial response. This is an issue on which tremendous philosophical advance has been made in the last 40 years or so. It used to be widely thought among philosophers that evil and suffering in the world were logically incompatible with the existence of an all-powerful and all-loving God. That viewpoint is now pretty much abandoned among professional philosophers. It has been realized that the atheist cannot successfully demonstrate any logical incompatibility between the propositions God exists and suffering and evil exist in the world. In fact, I think you can demonstrate that these are logically compatible simply by adding a third proposition, namely, God has morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evil in the world. As long as that proposition is even possibly true, it shows that there's no logical incompatibility between God's existence and the existence of the evil and suffering in the world. So what the atheist would have to do is show that it's logically impossible for God to have morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evil and suffering in the world. And that is a burden of proof so heavy that no atheist has ever been able to shoulder it. Now, the version of the problem of evil that is still very much alive and discussed today is what's sometimes called the probabilistic problem. And that would be for the atheist to say, all right, so God and evil are logically compatible, but nevertheless, given the evil and suffering in the world, it's improbable that God exists. Not impossible, but it's improbable that God exists, and therefore it's improbable that there is a God. And there's a great deal that needs to be said about that, but let me simply say this. The success of this atheistic argument will depend upon whether or not the atheist can demonstrate that it is improbable that God has morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evil and suffering in the world. And I think that that is also a proposition which far, far exceeds our capabilities of proving. I do not think that we are simply in a position to assess with any sort of reliability or confidence the probabilities as to whether or not God has morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evil and suffering in the world. God's morally sufficient reasons might be far more complex than we can imagine. They might not emerge until centuries later in human history, maybe in another land. We are simply not cognitively in a position to assess or to make such ambitious probability judgments. And lest you think this is special pleading for theism or for the belief in God, let me point out that this same critique has been successfully launched against an ethical theory known as utilitarianism. One version of utilitarianism says that we should always take that action or make that choice which will lead to the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. We should take that action or choice which will lead to the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. And this understanding of ethics is widely rejected because we are simply not in a position to know what actions we take will lead to the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. Something that looks like it's a great boon for mankind in the short run might turn out to be disastrous in the long run. And something that looks terrible in the short run might turn out to be a great benefit to mankind in the long run. We simply cannot make probability judgments about the effects, the ripple effects through history of the choices that we make here and now. And, of course, exactly the same point applies to the problem of evil. Some terrible evil in our lives, our son or daughters being hit by a car or dying of leukemia, might seem disastrous to us. But for all we know, God could have morally sufficient reasons for permitting that, which we may not discern successfully. So the atheist is making probability judgments in this respect, which I think are far in excess of our capability of making with any kind of confidence. So for that reason, I think the argument cannot go through successfully. Now, a great deal more needs to be said about this, but let me just wrap it up by saying one more thing, and it's this. I think that there is a good argument for the existence of God from evil. That's right. I think that evil actually proves that God exists. And my argument would go like this. Pardon me. Premise one, if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. I've defended that tonight. If there is no God, then we're just animals, and animals are not moral agents. Morality becomes expressions of personal taste or socio-biological patterns of behavior ingrained into us. So if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. Premise two, evil exists. This is the premise furnished by the atheist. Hitler, Saddam Hussein, and other sorts of things are genuinely evil. Three, therefore, objective moral values exist. That is to say, some things are evil. Four, therefore, God exists. So if objective moral values cannot exist without God, and objective moral values do exist, as is evident from the reality of evil, then it follows logically and inescapably that God exists. So even though evil on a surface level seems to call into question God's existence, on a deeper philosophical level, I think it actually demonstrates God's existence, since without God, good and evil as such would not exist. Yes?
You mentioned the Illuminati.
Yes.
And that their world philosophy would be dissatisfied, which is atheism.
All right, the question was, I said that the noble lie option would lead to an elitist group of Illuminati which would perpetrate the noble lie among the masses while not believing in it themselves. But then why in our secular society do we not have such a thing? Why do we, in fact, have a rise in secularism and atheism? Well, I think it's because we don't live in a culture in which there is a kind of group of Illuminati that control the government. At least we don't in our Western democracies. I think the Soviet Union, though, came close to something like this, where Marxism and the values of the proletariat revolution were mouthed by the leaders of the Soviet Union for the populace, but in fact they themselves didn't hold to those values. They weren't proletarians at all. They were bourgeois to the hilt. So we just don't live in a society like that. We live in a society in which, thankfully, there is a free exchange of ideas, and especially at the university, where one is free to propagate one's ideas.
My question wasn't really about...
All right, go ahead.
It was more about what is the point? Why would an atheist promote atheism?
Why would an atheist promote atheism? Well, maybe you should ask somebody, that fellow back there. Why would an atheist? Probably because he believes it's true. And I think if we read their books, read what people like Dawkins and Sam Harris have said, they believe that religion is really destructive to society and to human flourishing. Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, says that raising your child to be Catholic is more abusive of children than pedophilia. And if you don't believe that, read the book. He says pedophilia is not so serious an abuse of children as raising them to be good Catholics. So many of these atheists believe that religion is terribly, terribly deleterious to society. And in some respect, I think one can understand that. I think certainly various forms of religion have been deleterious. But I would say, look at the religion of Jesus of Nazareth and follow him. And I don't think I don't think a society that followed the ethics of the Sermon on the Mount would be oppressive and destructive of human flourishing. Quite the contrary. So I'm not here to promote religion as such, but to promote biblical Christianity, which would be the faith taught and modeled by Jesus of Nazareth. Yes?
Could there be any meaningful prospect of immortality that does not...
Could there be any form or prospect of immortality that does not posit the resurrection of the body with its stark particularity? Well, certainly you could have immortality of the soul without the body, and this Platonic sort of view of man was once very, very strong, but it seems to have collapsed in the face of modern atheism. People like Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and others tend to be reductionists with respect to human being. They don't believe that we are composites of body and soul, that either what we call the soul can be physically reduced to the brain, or else that there is a kind of non-reductive physicalism where mental states are just an ephemeral, what's called an epiphenomenon, that is to say, a kind of supervenient state on the physical brain that could not exist in the absence of the physical brain. So that if the brain is destroyed, this evanescence consciousness would just be annihilated as well. So you could logically have immortality without resurrection of the body if you go for some kind of a dualism, but that's not an option that contemporary atheists or naturalists are eager to embrace. Yes, this gentleman.
Going back to this to God, and thereby lost their preternatural gifts, etc., etc., mm-hmm. I was just wondering what standing this biblical explanation has in modern philosophy.
The question was, does the theological account of the origin of evil through an original human pair who fall into disobedience to God and so initiate evil in the world have much place in modern philosophical discussions of evil? It does not. And I think the reason is because the historical particularity of that pair isn't relevant to the central issue, which is freedom of the will. And that is certainly part and parcel, indeed at the center of contemporary discussions. Namely, that to be significant moral agents, we have to have freedom of the will to choose good or evil, so that it doesn't matter whether there was an original human pair or not. The fact is that every one of us, as a moral agent endowed with freedom of the will, faces a similar choice ourselves. And so the essence of the solution remains the same, namely creaturely free will is what introduces evil into the universe, at least moral evil, but it's not tied to any particular human pair or person.
Whereas the Christians would come from God and therefore have meaning, would you say that the Christians had some value above the atheists, even though they're exactly
The question, if I understood it, was if we imagine an atheist and a Christian, and they both affirm the same moral values, but the Christian bases them in God and the atheist has no basis.
Yeah.
Excuse me? In my view?
The atheists have no basis.
Yes.
Yeah. Then do the Christians have some validity above the atheist?
Does he have validity what?
Above
the atheist.
Above the atheist.
Yes. Does the Christian then in that situation have validity above the atheist? I don't like the language of above. I mean, it sounds like you're asserting some sort of superiority of the Christian. What I would say in that case is that they both affirm and recognize the same moral values, and that because the Christian is right that God does exist, they both perceive objective moral values, and therefore they're both right. So the atheist and the Christian alike agree, for example, that we ought to love our children. They both perceive the same moral value. They are both right. And the Christian is right that these are grounded in God. And the atheist simply fails to see where they're grounded. But he does see the correct value. Yes?
Why do they need to be grounded?
Well, that's been my whole argument tonight, is that apart from God, it's... I don't see any reason to think that the herd morality evolved by Homo sapiens on this planet is objective. On the atheistic view, moral values are either just expressions of personal taste, like one person says, I like chocolate the best. The other person says, no, I like vanilla. And it would be pointless for them to argue about which is objectively better tasting, vanilla or chocolate. Those are relative, subjective judgments. Or if you don't say that moral values are like that, then what moral values are patterns of behavior ingrained to us by sociobiological conditioning. In the struggle for survival, animals that have cooperative behavior are more apt to survive than those who don't exhibit that behavior. So in a baboon troop, some of the baboons will exhibit what we would call altruistic behavior. They will sacrifice self-interest for the good of the troop because this is genetically favorable in the struggle for survival, for these machines, as Dawkins calls them, to replicate their DNA. Even in an anthill, in an ant community, the fighter ants will sacrifice themselves for the heap of the ants because this is ingrained in them by genetic conditioning brought on by evolution. It has survival value. And that's all this herd morality would be. It's not an objective right or wrong. These are just patterns of behavior that evolution is ingrained into us. On the atheistic view, we're just animals. And animals aren't moral agents. When a lion kills a zebra, it kills it, but it doesn't murder it. Or when one hawk seizes a fish from the talons of another hawk, it takes the fish, but it doesn't steal the fish. Because, you see, there's no moral dimension to these actions. And on naturalism and atheism, I can't see any reason to think why human actions would have these peculiar moral qualities. And that's why we need a foundation. Do you want to follow up? No? Okay. Yes, this fellow. Oh, girl. A little louder, please.
Isn't the whole point, though, that we as reasonable beings have opinions? And, for example, majority of human beings do not want to be killed. Therefore,
yeah.
Why should we feel that we have the right to kill other people?
Yeah.
Murder?
Right. She suggests, why can't we have a sort of atheistic ethic that would be based on precisely these sorts of considerations that I've been talking about? We have a kind of inborn disposition to act cooperatively with others. We don't like hate. We don't want to die, and so forth. Well, the problem is because such a morality will be purely subjective. There's no reason to obey it, especially if it goes against your self-interest. It is an illusion. These things aren't really right and wrong. And therefore, it seems crazy for someone who is enlightened to follow such a delusion when it isn't really objective. There's nothing really wrong, for example, with raping someone. It's just a taboo that's been ingrained into us by sociobiological conditioning. But there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, acts that look like rape go on all the time in the animal kingdom, because if a male animal is apt to coerce itself upon a female, it's more apt to spread its genes and propagate its progeny. So it can actually be evolutionarily advantageous for a male animal to practice rape on occasion, and that goes on in the animal world. Now, if you think that that is morally abhorrent, well, I agree with you, and therefore we need to find some sort of a foundation for saying that these things are really wrong, not just that they're unfashionable. The rapist isn't like the person who wears white socks with a tuxedo. You know, that's just being unfashionable. We want to say, I think, more than that, that this is morally wrong. And you can't do that on atheism, in my view. Oh. Yeah. Oh, I think this is hope. Yeah, she suggests that the rapist may want to rape someone else, but he doesn't want to be raped and assaulted himself. So one will adopt a code where, you know, if you don't do this to me, I won't do this to you. I think that's a hopeless foundation for ethics. For one thing, it leaves us incapable of saying that a society which all agreed to propagate some morally abhorrent behavior is wrong. For example, National Socialist Germany. They basically all agreed that it was good to exterminate the Jews and the Gypsies and the homosexuals and the Jehovah's Witnesses, to put them in camps and gas them. And this went on for a decade without any serious opposition in that society, because they had more or less all agreed that this could be done and it was a good thing to do. Or in Afrikaner or South Africa, apartheid was a system that worked pretty well by a social contract there. So I don't think that we can successfully propagate that kind of a system. And besides, that really doesn't get at the key issue. We want to say that these acts are wrong, not just that they're against this kind of self-interest societal agreement that we've had. And then the other problem with that is, what about the person who doesn't want to be part of the agreement? What about the psychopath or the sociopath who says, I don't buy into the social contract, I'm going to go my own way? That person doesn't sign on to the contract, and so he has no obligation to do any of these things. And therefore, on this view, he doesn't do anything wrong when he does these actions. And moreover, reading one social contract theorist, Jan Narveson, who is a Canadian social contract theorist, he says, what we should do with this person who won't buy into the contract, he says, that person, because he's not in the contract, also has no rights himself, and therefore, he says, we can be free to kill him if we want to. Well, to me, this is mad if you're talking about morality, that you can go kill an innocent person just because he doesn't buy into your contract. But that would follow from that view, because he's not in the contract, and so he has no rights. And I think it's evident that morality is more than that. And of course, you know, if you're sufficiently powerful, you don't have to worry about others doing this to you anyway. If you're a Ferdinand Marcos or a Papadoc Duvalier or even a Donald Trump, you can pretty much safely live in self-indulgence and not worry, you know, about other people doing this to you. You can get away with it. On this view, the mistake that Jeff Skilling made was that he got caught, you know, not that he did anything really wrong. So I think that this kind of self-interest ethics is just completely hopeless myself. Yes? Yeah. All right. The question was, what is the relationship between science and religion, particularly with respect to human evolution? I think that science and religion have overlapping domains, that as science explores the natural world, it encounters certain metaphysical questions which it cannot answer, but which are signs of transcendence, pointing beyond the natural world to its ground in a supernatural creator and designer. I would think that, for example, the evidence for the Big Bang origin of the universe out of nothing at a point in the finite past is such a signpost, pointing beyond the universe to its ground in a transcendent creator. I would say that the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life is a similar signpost, pointing beyond the physical world to a supernatural designer of the cosmos. Now, with respect to biological evolution, I really am quite open-minded about that. As I said, I'm not a research scientist, certainly not a biologist. I'm a layman with only a layman's interest in this subject. And therefore, I have no strong opinions about how God created human beings, whether he did so through special acts of creation or whether he did this through evolutionary development. I am open to the evidence. And I think as a religious believer, I can be objective in a way that the naturalist and atheist cannot. You see, I can follow the evidence wherever it leads. But for the naturalist, he cannot, because on his view, evolution is the only game in town. No matter how improbable, no matter how fantastic the odds, it has to be true, because there is no intelligent designer beyond the universe. Whereas I'm free to follow the evidence where it leads me. And at this point, I'm maintaining an open mind and ready to be convinced of whichever looks best. I will say this, however, from what I've read, it does seem to me that the current theory is explanatorily inadequate. It seems to me that the mechanisms of random mutation and natural selection operate so slowly that it is fantastically improbable that this degree of biological complexity could have evolved upon the Earth in relatively a short time of, say, 4.8 billion years or so. In their book, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle, John Barrow and Frank Tipler list 10 steps in the course of the evolution of Homo sapiens, such as the origin of mitochondria in the cell, the origin of photosynthesis, the origin of an endoskeleton, the origin of the human eye, and so forth. 10 steps in the evolution of Homo sapiens, each of which is so improbable that before it would have occurred, the sun would have ceased to be a main sequence star and would have incinerated the Earth. And yet all 10 have occurred, if the theory is correct, in order for us to be here today. So that what the theory imagines is so fantastically improbable, it seems that some sort of divine supervision or superintendence would be required in order for it to occur. If the theory of evolution is true, it seems to me it would be literally a miracle, and therefore evidence for the existence of God. Yes, down here. Okay, the question was, I spoke of Christians as having the obligation to fight against oppression, but she says it seems that Christianity is subjective because, after all, hasn't the church propagated things like the Crusades, which would be oppressive and so forth. Now, just let me ask you a question. Do you think that the Crusades are consistent or were consistent with the ethics of Jesus of Nazareth? Okay.
Because they could have been, I'm not in the position to say exactly what the Crusaders were fighting, but they might have
All right.
been doing it to the Muslims because they believe that the Muslims should believe in Jesus.
All right. Her response was, for those who didn't hear, she wasn't sure. She's not sure what the Crusaders were fighting for, but maybe they thought that they should fight because the Muslims should believe in Jesus. But do you think Jesus would have sanctioned the use of violence in order to get someone to believe in him?
Personally, no, but these people are calling themselves Christians.
Right.
So where do you...
But you would agree that he would not?
I'd say that.
No. So wouldn't you agree then that what the Crusaders did was inconsistent with the ethics of Jesus?
So are they not real Christians?
Well, they were she asked then, are they not real Christians? I won't pronounce on whether they were real Christians, but I think we could say that insofar as they acted inconsistently with the ethics of Jesus, they were acting in an unchristian way. They were behaving in a non-Christian way. And certainly all of us are fallen and imperfect people, and we often will do things that are unchristian. Even I'm talking here about those of us who are Christians. We will do things that are unchristian. And in moments like that, we need to confess and ask God's forgiveness and cleansing and mercy and then go on. So I don't think that the example you use shows at all that Christianity is subjective. On the contrary, I think what it shows is that sometimes Christians behave in ways that are objectively wrong because they're inconsistent with the teaching and values of Jesus. Well, I see our moderator is here at my left hand calling things to a quit, so I'll turn it back over to him.